Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty, my co-host, is out today. Our week in review begins with Governor Deval Patrick's latest effort to control government health care spending on state and municipal retirees. Here he is earlier today unveiling a plan that he says will save the state big money.
The projected savings for state and municipal governments over the next decades is up to $20 billion.
We'll delve into the politics behind the proposal. Also this week, the governor's plan to consolidate management of the state's public housing authorities. He wants to replace the hodgepodge of some 240 separate authorities with six regional agencies, part of an effort to eliminate corruption and waste.
We expect that there are tens of millions of dollars that can be captured and reinvested in our public housing assets.
And in the case against reputed Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger, this week it was the case against Judge Richard Stearns and questions over whether he can rule impartially.
The trial must be overseen by a judge who is not connected to the most infamous period in federal law enforcement history Boston.
And the flu epidemic touches down in 44 states and hits Massachusetts particularly hard, with more than 750 confirmed cases in Boston alone.
There are some things that define comfort.
And in the case that has jeopardized tens of thousands of drug cases across the state, former state chemist Annie Ducan was busy this week pleading not guilty in multiple courtrooms. Those are this week's top local stories, and we're going to tackle them right now with two esteemed members of our Week in Review panel. With me in the studio, WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Hey, David, great to see you.
Hi, same here. Anthony.
Happy Friday. And Julie Mahegan, deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Herald. Julie, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony.
So let's start with the news today. Governor Patrick's proposal to rein in health care payments to future state and municipal retirees. Under the plan, public employees would have to work until age 60 instead of the current age of 55 before they become eligible for state health care benefits. Here's the governor.
The projected savings for state and municipal governments over the next decades is up to $20 billion. This we will achieve while still providing a fair retirement benefit to employees who have provided a long tenure of service to the public.
So the governor is casting this as part of an effort to control those unsustainable runaway government costs. Unions and retirees usually oppose changes like this, but this proposal is based on recommendations of a commission made up of labor and retiree groups. So does it look like he'll be able to push this through? Let me start with you, Julie.
It seems that way. I mean, we haven't heard the immediate condemnations that we often hear when it comes to municipal or at least labor-related reforms. I have seen a few little chirps here and there from various individual unions that oppose this proposal. But, you know, frankly, I think part of the reason why it has some momentum is because it's absolutely unavoidable.
It's unavoidable. These costs are spiraling out of control.
Right. I don't think this would be Deval Patrick's first choice of reforms to take on necessarily. You know, Democratic governor with a strong support from organized labor in the state, but he sees the numbers that everybody else has seen. And this is Mass Taxpayers Foundation did a study in, I think it was 2011, that the largest 50 cities and towns in Massachusetts have an unfunded liability, meaning they owe their retirees $20 billion in health care alone. That's not the pensions. That's health care costs. And they don't have the money to pay for it. So it's not something that's going to go away.
And that's why you hear town managers and city managers complaining bitterly about their budgets and what they have to cut out of local budgets because of those costs, those soaring costs. And you hear a lot of bitterness. Some of them are signing these contracts that bind them into the costs, but still, it's a tough situation for them. So they want outside help, and this is the kind of outside help that they will welcome. And I think it's just part of the political tone now that unions are understanding they have to give give backs. And we are in the time of that. And I think that's why there's less opposition to it.
And let's remember, I mean, there are some decent reforms in here, but we're not talking about something that's particularly drastic. First of all, it only applies to future employees who enter the retirement system.
So people who are already retired now are not affected.
Not only are people who are retired now not affected, but nobody who's currently paying into the retirement system would be affected. Anybody who for future retirees. I'm sorry. I think actually people who are within 5 years of retirement are not can't be expected to pay
the higher
rate.
Which makes it
rate.
More palatable.
I think it does.
I mean, I'm wondering if there's any criticism about this plan. I mean, the governor argues that state and local governments can't afford the tens of billions of dollars in long-term health care obligations. Do you think this proposal goes far enough? I mean, are we going to hear a criticism that it doesn't go far enough? What do you think, Julie?
In Massachusetts, I don't know that we'll necessarily hear very loud criticism that it doesn't go far enough. I mean, you might hear the Republican minority in the House and Senate talk about the need for some additional reforms. And to be fair, I think labor would probably make the point that, as David said, you know, a lot of these are contracts that municipal officials entered into. It's a sort of the same issue that came up when we were talking about municipal health care reform and giving cities and towns more control over drawing up their health care plans, is that, you know, they sort of got us into this mess a little bit, too. So,
David, you were about to.
Again, I've been out to cities and towns talking to managers, and they're looking at stripped down budgets. Mm-hmm. They've been making terrible choices over the last couple of years, and they've had to closing services, shutting services down that used to be, people took for granted. So they're looking at this, and this is going to be welcomed.
I think the chickens are coming home to roost, as it were.
Well, speaking of that, let's move on to another effort this week by the governor to save the state money. This has to do with his proposal to reorganize and consolidate the state's ornate array of public housing authorities. These are the entities that run public housing, which shelters more than 300,000 people in the Commonwealth. And did you know that there are something like 240 separate public housing authorities across the states? Across this state, only the state of Texas, according to the Boston Globe, has more housing boards than Massachusetts. So the governor wants to replace this array of this hodgepodge of public housing authorities with six regional agencies. And David, what do you make of this effort on part of the governor? Will it work?
The big selling point is a number, $360,000.
That's one salary.
That was one salary in Chelsea, and that's that is the advertisement for this bill. But, you know,
Before you race on, that's Michael McLaughlin's salary, the former Chelsea housing director, right?
Exactly. Yeah. 360 big ones. I went to graduate school in botany, and, you know, in science there are two groups in botany. There are the splitters and the lumpers. You know, do you big groups or small groups? And this is the lumping school of thought. And it also is associated with Democrats more often than not. I think even though you have 240,
I believe the number is.
One of the things they represent, and we know what the excess is, is local control and decentralized decision making, which might be better on a local level.
Julie, what's your view of
this?
Well,
you won't be surprised as a member of the Herald editorial board that I probably am more of a splitter than a lumper. we, in an editorial today, called the governor's proposal a power grab. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of local housing officials who would echo that point of view. You know, we tend to shy away from proposals that say, okay, well, you at the local level, you folks who are closest to the problem at hand and are dealing with the problem at hand, we actually in Boston know much better how to deal with this problem. Now, that's not to say that there isn't room for some regionalization, which the administration talks about, and some sort of pooling of services. But this
proposal. But Julie, because I want to ask you, 240 separate public housing authorities. I mean, I would think that, I mean, you folks at the Herald might look at that and say, isn't that a recipe for patronage and waste and favors?
First of all, not necessarily. I mean, I hear your point, but if there's adequate oversight, mm-hmm. I mean, the state has an oversight role here that they had abandoned, really. Mm-hmm. And they've, so there's that point. And number two, This proposal, as far as I can tell, does not call for any job reductions. I mean, we would do away with local housing commissions. So you do away with or housing authority boards, I should say. You do away with the sort of the folks in town who get together once every 2 weeks and talk about housing policy. But you wouldn't necessarily get rid of, a lot of the public jobs that go along with this. Mm. So if it's sort of the worst of both worlds, as far as I can tell.
I think what you need is an inspection function here. So just like with pharmaceutical compounding groups, local housing boards need more regulation and inspectors from outside.
Well, and to be fair, again, to the Patrick administration, there were some reforms that were implemented in the immediate wake of the Chelsea story, because housing authority boards are now required to submit independent audits.
Right.
There's a cap now on what directors can make. So they have taken some steps, but that's why I think those are decent steps, and more steps like that can be taken. But this seems like an overreaction to a problem, in a couple of isolated cases.
Well, let's listen to the governor on this, because this would strip down and eliminate a lot. It would also put, as you've said, Julie, a lot more power in the governor's hands. The six regional housing authorities would be controlled by a 9-member board appointed by the governor. But here's the governor speaking earlier this week, who says local communities would retain some measure of control over their housing.
Local communities will retain control over land use and significant redevelopment decisions, including siting decisions, change of use of an existing building or vacant lot, and tenant engagement.
So that's the governor's position. But, Julie, does it still put too much power in the executive?
Well, I think I'd want to drill down very specifically in what he means by local control over significant redevelopment decisions and things like that. As far as I understand it, this proposal would take ownership and management responsibility and responsibility for capital decision making, which is basically everything that it is. And property, did I say property management? Yeah. So, I mean, the state basically becomes the tenant landlord.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the slow-moving case against reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger. He's expected to go on trial for multiple murders. But this week, it was federal judge Richard Stearns who was on trial. He's the presiding judge in the case. But back in the 1980s, he was a top federal prosecutor while Bulger was an FBI informant. So Bulger's lawyer, J.W. Carney, wants him off the case, because he says Judge Stearns can't be impartial, or at least presents the appearance of not being impartial.
The trial must be overseen by a judge who is not connected to the most infamous period in federal law enforcement history in Boston.
David, you've done some great reporting on this story. Tell us about the significance of this challenge, which came in a federal appeals court this week.
You know, it's interesting. This has gone on now for quite some time. And what's happened is that now Judge Stearns has become the distraction on the case. And paradoxically, the longer he maintains a silence now, because he did not accept the invitation of the three judges on the appeals court to come forward, he seems to become intransigent here. And so there is that concern. You know, somebody told me, a practitioner in the courts once told me, if you want to drive a judge crazy, ask him to recuse himself. And in Stern's very first response to Carney, there were sharp words used, and he made categorical statements. So this is an issue, but people have to remember, everyone has to remember, that appearance is as important as the reality of bias. And so in the end, a judge is called forward and asked to step aside if, in fact, he thinks that reasonable people might think, not determine he is, but might think, it might appear that he can't be impartial. That's the test. And so we're getting more and more attention to Stearns. And frankly, I think he's been hurt in the discussion and the questions that Carney has raised.
Julie, what's your view of this situation?
Well, obviously, David is following this a lot more closely than I am. But as somebody sort of viewing this just like a regular reader or listener, I think it strikes me that Jay Carney is doing sort of a masterful job at dangling something shiny in front of whether it's the public or the rest of the legal community, and saying, you know, I think he single-handedly has made this a cause celeb in a way.
He has. No, he has.
And I mean, there's obviously a legal case to be made. He wouldn't just be doing it if it were frivolous. But I think that it helps immensely to further this perception that nobody in the federal law enforcement community could be trusted.
Let's listen to Carney before I get you to answer,
sure,
David,
sure.
Because it sort of gives us a glimpse in how he plans to defend Bulger, and we've talked about this.
And by the way, he's the only one that's talking because the other side isn't, so
yeah,
he commands the stage.
Right.
Well, here's Carney, and the idea here is that as an FBI informant, Bulger had immunity from prosecution back in the day, and here's J.W. Carney.
If James Bulger was allegedly committing dozens and dozens of crimes, including murders, why wasn't he prosecuted?
It's an intriguing question, David.
It is, but I'll tell you, I don't think that line of argument, the business, the contention, he has immunity, I do not think that's a dog that's going to hunt here in the end. The more important question, though, is why is the judge refusing to recuse himself? And remember, Julie, we go back, and this is no normal case, because this is the very U.S. Attorney's Office, the very federal district where the worst kinds of corruption occurred in the past, where a search, and inefficient, ineffective, and sometimes a suspicious search for Bulger was questioned by the public. So you had all sorts of people in the public who don't trust the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, or the Department of Justice here, and now you have a chance with Bulger back to do the case, to convict him in a fair trial. Why would you want to take any chances that a very solid federal case against him might be overturned at some point at an age where Bulger might not be able to be tried again, where there are witnesses that won't be able to return, and maximize the damage to families who are waiting for a verdict?
I think
that's a great point.
Yeah, I think it'll all come down, as David says, to the appearance factor. I will say I understand, as you say, about why judges don't necessarily rush out and say why they. Yeah, I think
they want to think of themselves as being able to be impartial.
Right, they don't want to have basically their integrity questioned, and to sort of acknowledge that. To talk about it would be to acknowledge it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of professional pride here involved, I imagine. This is one of the sort of great trials of the century. Who wouldn't want a piece of that? I mean, it'd be...
There may be something to that, too.
But it is, but the call for justice, though, is for judges to step aside from that and to say, if you step aside, it doesn't mean you can't be impartial. It means you're doing it because you want to allay public suspicions of the system.
All right. Well, let's move on from that effort to untangle a rather elaborate mess to another effort to untangle perhaps an even bigger mess. Annie Ducan, the former state chemist who allegedly compromised tens of thousands of drug samples at the state crime lab, was back in court this week, where she pleaded not guilty in two separate courtrooms to two charges of obstruction of justice. She faces 27 separate charges, including perjury and tampering with evidence. We also learned this week that 2 years ago, her husband warned a prosecutor by text message that his wife was a compulsive liar, that according to documents obtained by the Boston Globe. Now, Julie and David, I'm not sure exactly what to ask about this story. It just seems to get more bizarre, but there we are. And is the state, are we any closer to digging our way out of this mess?
The theme here, Julie, is money and messes today. And on that note, let me just talk about the money here. We have, at this point, we now have the governor's asking for $30 million to deal with this problem. The state judiciary says it needs $9 million. That's only going to involve a year and a half of litigation. Mayor Menino wants $15 million to handle the potential release of people. The judiciary says it needs more money. The district attorneys want $10 million more. The state attorney general says she needs $2 million just due to the inquiry. And finally, the CPCS, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, estimates it may need $300 million to deal with this problem. You have the courts, they're hiring retired judges, clerks, clerk magistrates. They got to deal with this problem. Where's the money going to come from? It's a mess.
It's a mess.
The thing that I found so telling about the story this week of this fellow who was arrested in Chelsea, in a Chelsea McDonald's, he was arrested for public drinking. And what he tells the arresting officers, as I believe he was allegedly resisting arrest, was, "I just got out on an Annie Ducan." Now, that to me sort of speaks volumes about what the criminal justice system is going to be dealing with in the aftermath of all of this. I mean, I've talked, Commissioner Ed Davis in Boston, you know, has said this is an enormous problem that the city is going to be dealing with, is a sort of recidivism of some of these folks who get out.
Enormous problems. They may not be able to buy their way out of it, which then comes to the other solution, which is you're going to have to release people, and you may have to release a lot of people. So there may be hundreds, if not more, doing the Annie Ducan.
Well, we already know that prosecutors have already released about 159 defendants, is the last number that I've seen, who were convicted based on drug analysis by Annie Ducan. Obviously, there are going to be many, many more.
And at least, I think it's at least a half a dozen of those have been rearrested in the weeks since they were released.
And that story of the story of the guy in Chelsea who was later found, Anthony, to have eight bags of, well, we now know we shouldn't say it was cocaine. It has to be tested first.
Right.
But that person is indicative of problems they're going to face. And there are more prosecutorial issues, though. How many assistant DAs were calling the lab and calling people and saying such things as, "I need this, I need a result"? That needs to be investigated further.
All right, folks. Well, it's a big mess, and obviously it's a mess we're going to be following and talking about for many months, if not years, to come. So let's move on to our hubbub, that story that fell below the fold this week. Let me start with you, David. What's your hubbub?
Mine's glum. You know, anybody that's been concerned about civil liberties being hollowed out in the justice system in the last decades are going to find no solace in what happened in Maryland this week with the case of Private Bradley Manning. So, of course, he's accused of turning a trove of classified documents over to WikiLeaks. So a military judge determines that, yes, he was confined to a 6-by-8-foot cell for 23 to 24 hours a day. He was shackled for the brief time he was let out, and he was forced to be naked at night, treatment that the president had said he'd been assured was acceptable. But no, says the judge, there was no intent to punish Bradley, and therefore no one was to be held responsible. But by the way, the judge read her ruling, which is the only way we know what she said, because written rulings, transcripts, and filings in that court are considered military secrets that are unavailable to the public.
Glum indeed. Julie, something to brighten the end of this week in review.
Please.
Well, from truth to fiction, I guess I would say, is that, you know, it's kind of sounds strange to say poor Ben Affleck, because Ben Affleck is anything but poor. But look, the guy was passed over for Best Director nominee for the Academy Awards this week. I think a lot of people assumed that he was going to get the nod. I've always found it strange when a movie is nominated for Best Film, but the director, who's basically responsible for everything in it but the acting, isn't nominated. So he is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director, and I know Amy Poehler said that she hopes he wins so that she can hand him the award and say it was for the film Argo. And so we have to be pulling for the local guy on that front.
All right, here's for the local guy. Okay, here's my hubbub. It involves the flu epidemic, which has already touched down in some 44 states. We know that Massachusetts is one of the hardest hit. The city of Boston, as we know, declared a public health emergency this week. There are more than 750 confirmed cases of influenza. And so here's Mayor Menino, who announced that the city would provide free flu shots this weekend in an attempt to stop the spread of the virus.
The best thing you can do to protect yourself and your family is to get the flu shot. I've had my flu shot. I'm asking you to get yours, too.
All right, good advice. But now here's the thing, and here's now we're getting to my hubbub. So not long ago, I took my 15-year-old daughter to get her a flu shot. And one of the most convenient ways, as we know, to do that is at the CVS, right? Go into the CVS, or even the Walgreens will do it. But I learned they will not give a shot to a minor under 18 years old, even with her father sitting right there. So I just thought that was curious. I'm sure there's a good reason for it. I'm going to sort of look into that.
Don't be so sure.
Okay, maybe I shouldn't be so sure. But I thought it strange, because it seems like we should be doing everything we can to facilitate the ease of getting these shots. And instead, we had to make an appointment, take her to the pediatrician, and do all of that, which, of course, is doable.
but just not nearly as convenient. So there you have
another
it.
Item for healthcare cost reform.
There we go. Julie Mohegan, Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Herald, thank you so much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Anthony.
And David Boeri, WBUR Senior Reporter, always great to have you. Have a great
Same
weekend.
Great to be here, Anthony.
Listeners, stay with us. Up next, a conversation with a teacher at the just-shuttered Gloucester Community Arts Charter School about the challenges facing the charter school movement. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.